There should be a handout back there for you, although I don't see Ron. There's... All right, Eric's back there. Anybody need a handout? Just put your hand up. And let's open our Bibles this evening, if we could, to 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9. And Eric, you might think about closing that door back there. Well, actually, we don't want to close it on people because it cuts down on the noise just a little bit. And this is our last study of this quarter, as you know. And we're going to have a summer break, and we're coming back, I think, September the 4th. Does that sound right? So the summer months will go by fast. Don't do too much daydreaming. Stay in the Word. And when we come back in the fall, I think this will, I'm anticipating another quarter, and we should be able to finish the study on the kingdom. But in the book that I wrote, which is just a topical organization of biblical material, we're in chapter 20. And I did get a call from somebody this week who writes 1,000-page books. And I know who he is. He's sort of famous in the scholarly world, in the free grace circles anyway. And he had read my book, and he really liked it. He didn't agree with everything, but that's okay. But he says, I really liked how you tackled all the passages that go against your position. And I said, can I get your voice on recording and share that with my church? Because I think I've killed those poor people, dragging them through all this material. But as you know, we're basically teaching the concept that the kingdom is a postponed reality. And if that's true, what about all the passages, you know, where people seem to gravitate towards arguing that we're in the kingdom? So that's sort of the work that we're doing right now. And we're sort of coming near the end of that section. But we've looked at alleged kingdom now passages in the ministry of Christ, in the book of Acts, in the writings of the Apostle Paul. And now we're sort of wrapping up a little bit of that biblical material by looking at alleged kingdom now passages in the general letters and the book of Revelation. So last week we looked at Hebrews 12:28, and we were in the process of looking at 1 Peter 2 and verse 9. How's the sound system doing tonight? Are you guys okay with it? You guys thumbs up? Okay, I'm feeling a little bit of an echo, but if you guys are happy, I'm happy. Happy sheep is a happy shepherd. Amen. Is that in the Bible somewhere? I don't know if I can find the exact verse, but you guys get the drift. Anyway, we are in 1 Peter 2, verse 9, which says, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who has called you out of darkness into the marvelous light. So do you recall where Peter is quoting from there in 1 Peter 2, verse 9? Quoting Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6. Basically, information that God had given to Israel at Mount Sinai. And it's there that God told the nation of Israel that they are a kingdom of priests. So, according to Kingdom Now theology, because Exodus 19 is quoted in 1 Peter 2, verse 9, and because Exodus 19 calls Israel a kingdom of priests, because it's quoted in the New Testament, the church is therefore the kingdom. In fact, this gentleman here, Paul Ochtemeyer, is basically saying that the church is the new Israel. Replacement theology. He says the twofold description of the new community, 1 Peter 2, verse 5 and verses 9 and 10, shows by its language that the church has now, look at this language, taken over the role of Israel. So that's very common to see things like that. And yet what we're teaching here is that the kingdom is future. And the church really is an interruption in God's program with Israel. And certainly not a replacement of it. So how would we handle 1 Peter 2 verse 9? Well, one of the things we talked about last time is that similarity is not the same thing as equality. I mean, let's pretend that all of the promises related to Israel in Exodus 19 are quoted in 1 Peter 2, verse 9, to the whole church. Even that in and of itself would not prove kingdom now theology. Peter's point could simply be the church is similar to Israel, but similarity is not the same thing as equality. So, you know, Israel and the church are very different, but there are points of similarity, right? Both Israel and the church are given a worldwide mission. Both Israel and the church are God's representatives on earth. Both Israel and the church are called to holiness. Both Israel and the church are God's people, but that doesn't mean the church is Israel, right? So, I think I used the analogy last time of the two cars in my garage. Did I use that? I mean, those cars look an awful lot like each other. But just because they're similar doesn't mean that car A is car B. And you know that my wife drives one car and I drive another car. And you can tell the difference between the two because mine is very clean. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just joking. I don't think she's amused back there. That's right. Mine is clean some of the time. Hers is clean all the time. That's what I meant to say. So just because two cars look alike doesn't mean car A equals car B. So we talked about that last time, right? Not my wife's car, but this verse. So let me give you another way to handle 1 Peter. Now, let's see. Last time I checked, the ladies' Bible study was teaching 1 Peter, right? Or are they teaching it currently? Okay, so they just completed a year ago. Okay, so there I am. I'm real up to speed on things. So this, what we're going to talk about here, point B, is very helpful to studies in 1 Peter. Because most people misunderstand 1 Peter. And my point here in letter B is that 1 Peter was not written to the whole church. And I know that's sort of a paradigm shift for a lot of people. Because after all, 1 Peter's in the New Testament. 1 Peter's a letter. Therefore, 1 Peter's written to the whole church. But I want to show you tonight that 1 Peter was not written to the whole church. It was written to a group within the church. Now, am I saying that there's nothing in 1 Peter for us as Gentiles? Of course, there's many applications you can make to us. In fact, when you read 1 Peter, you'll see a lot of things in there that you can directly apply to your life. What I'm saying is you can't build a theology from a verse in 1 Peter 2, verse 9, to support the idea that somehow the church has replaced Israel, when 1 Peter 2, verse 9, was never written to the whole church. It has a much narrower meaning. And so that's sort of the reason I'm bringing this up. So this is sort of counterintuitive to a lot of people, so let me try to give you some evidence for this. We'll look at evidence from 1 Peter itself. Then I'll answer some arguments that people use to argue that no, 1 Peter is written to the whole church. And then I'll show you very quickly what the early church fathers believed on this. And then I'll kind of bring it to a conclusion and explain why this matters. I mean, the reason I'm going into this is because you read statements like this by Paul Ochtemeyer. He's building a whole theology on 1 Peter 2, verse 9. And in the process, he's assuming that Peter was written to the church as a whole. 1 Peter was not written to the church as a whole. 1 Peter was written to a group within the church. Who was 1 Peter written to? Believing Jews within the church. And if that's true, it undermines what Ochtemeyer is trying to do here with 1 Peter 2, verse 9. So what is some evidence from 1 Peter itself? Well, take a look. We've got, what is that, six pieces of evidence. Take a look at 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 1. Notice what 1 Peter 1, verse 1 says. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who reside as aliens scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia, who are chosen. Now, do you notice something about this? Most New Testament letters, when they're written to the church or the churches, will say to the what? To the church at Rome. To the church at Philippi. To the church at Colossae. To the churches in Galatia. Does Peter say that at all? He doesn't say that at all. He doesn't even say to the church or to the churches of. So that's sort of your first clue that he's not writing something to the church. He's writing to a narrower group of people. Second piece of evidence, staying in 1 Peter 1, verse 1, is this word scattered, which is a translation of the Greek word diaspora. Diaspora. Notice 1 Peter 1, 1 again. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who reside as aliens, scattered, and there I've got the Greek noun translated scattered in brackets, the diaspora. Now, when you do a word study on diaspora, some pronounce it diaspora. It just depends on which syllable gets the emphasis, as I like to say. That word always means the Jews, without exception. It's only used two other times in the New Testament. You might hold your place here in 1 Peter and travel back a book or two. Actually, travel back one book to the book of James. James, a bondservant and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes who are what? Dispersed. That's the Greek noun diaspora. Now, is that written to a Jewish audience? It has to be because it's written to the 12 tribes. By the way, when you watch A&E and the History Channel, they're all going to tell you that the 12 tribes are lost. So they think that the northern scattering of the tribes by the Assyrians caused the 12 tribes to disappear 700 years before the time of Christ. Well, that's kind of odd, isn't it? Because James didn't think they were lost. James, 700 years later, is writing a book to the 12 tribes. But there you'll see very clearly that diaspora, or scattered, means the Jews. And the word is only used one other time. If you go back to John 7 and verse 35, Jesus uses the same noun, the diaspora. And it says there, the Jews then said to one another, where does this man intend to go that we will not find him? Is he intending to go into the dispersion amongst the Greeks and teach the Greeks, is he? So Jesus had told them, you know, in a little while longer you will not see me. And they misunderstood what he was saying. And the Jews started to say to themselves, well, where is he going? He must be going off into the dispersion. And in context, they're talking about the Jewish dispersion, the diaspora. And when you go into what's called the Septuagint, you know what the Septuagint is? It's a Greek translation of the Old Testament. It's created about 200 years, roughly 150 to 200 years before the time of Christ. It was created because Alexander the Great in the intertestamental period had made the Greek language the known language of the whole world. And folks wanted to be able to read Hebrew Bible in Greek. And the Hebrew Bible was not originally written in Greek. It was written in which language? Hebrew. That's why we call it Hebrew Bible. And a touch of Aramaic here and there. So what do you do if you're a Greek-speaking person and you want to read Hebrew Bible in Greek? Well, you have to read a translation of it, the Septuagint. And in the Septuagint, I have all of the examples where diaspora is used, and it always means, the Greek word diaspora always means Jews. And then you get into some writings called the pseudepigraphical writings, and what are called the Apocrypha. Now, these are basically historical books that we as Protestants don't accept as inspired. But when you do a word study of diaspora in those books, what you'll discover, and I have all of the references there on the screen, that diaspora, once again, always refers to the Jews scattered outside their land. So when you do a word study on this, you'll find that diaspora is a technical word always referring to Jews outside the land every single time. So when Peter uses that noun, diaspora, I think he's using it in the exact same way. Now, John MacArthur, in his MacArthur Study Bible, for whatever reason, tries to blunt the force of this argument. And he tries to say, well, the article, definite article, like in front of nouns, you have definite articles like the cat. Cat would be the noun, the would be the definite article. John MacArthur tries to blunt the force of this argument, and he tries to make it sound like this book was really written to Gentiles. And he says, well, the definite article is found in John 7:35 and in James chapter 1, verse 1, and it's not found here in 1 Peter 1, verse 1. So somehow, in his mind, that changes the meaning of diaspora and makes it Gentile. I'm not really sure what MacArthur's motivations are for saying that. But the fact of the matter is, the definite article, whether it's there or not, never changes the meaning of a word. It may change the intensification of a word, but not its meaning. For example, the definite article is not found in front of the word apostle in 1 Peter 1, verse 1 either. That doesn't change the fact that Peter was an apostle. It just doesn't intensify it by saying the apostle. So I just throw that in because, you know, a lot of people think that this book was written to Gentiles because of statements like that in the MacArthur Study Bible. And I don't know why he's arguing that. And I don't think he really has much of a linguistic argument. So why do I think this was written to Jews? A, it doesn't say the church or the churches of. B, the word diaspora always means Jews outside the land. Everywhere else it's used. So why wouldn't it mean that here? And then when you go back to 1 Peter 1, verse 1, Peter, number 3, uses the words not just diaspora or scattered, but he uses the word aliens. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who reside as aliens, scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia who are chosen. Now, when you start tracking down this word aliens, he also uses it, if you jump over to 1 Peter 2, verse 11, he uses the word aliens. He says, "Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage against the soul." So, aliens, para, epi, demois, if I'm pronouncing that right, is only used three times in the New Testament. And it only refers to Jews. It's used twice in Peter, and it's used one other time in the book of Hebrews, Hebrews chapter 11, verse 13. So just like the word scattered, the word aliens has a technical meaning. You know what I mean by a technical meaning? A word that always means the same thing everywhere it's used. So just like the word scattered, aliens always means Jews. So since Peter uses that in verse 1 of chapter 1 and also chapter 2, verse 11, that's another reason I think he's writing to a Jewish audience. In fact, when you actually look at that word there, pare or par epi demois, what does that mean? Par means away in Greek. Epi means from. Now, in that last part of the word there, demois, if I'm pronouncing that right, do you see anything in English? Any English words that remind you of that final word, demois? D-E-M-O-I-S. Doesn't it kind of look like domestic? Maybe the word democracy? So that part of the word means home. So para epi demois is what you call a compound word. It's multiple words making up a single word. And when you actually look at it piece by piece, it literally means away from home. Now, wouldn't that be a great description of the Jews at this time that Peter was writing? As many of them had been scattered and pushed out of their homeland through the persecution of Saul, Acts 8, who became Paul, Acts 9. So why am I convinced that Peter is writing here to a Jewish audience? He doesn't say church or churches. He uses very specific words like diaspora and aliens, which are only used of Jewish people. And there's a fourth reason why I think Peter is writing to a Jewish audience. Peter distinguishes his audience from the Gentiles. He carves them out separately from the Gentiles in two places. And in so doing, he's identifying ethnically that his audience is different than the Gentiles. If his audience is different from the Gentiles, then his audience must be what? Jewish. Take a look at 1 Peter 2, verse 12. He says, "Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles." What's a Gentile? A non-Jew. And he uses the word ethnos for nations to distinguish his audience from the non-Jews. If he's distinguishing his audience from the non-Jews, then his audience must be what? Must be Jewish. Notice 1 Peter chapter 4. And notice, if you will, verse 3. He says, "For the time already has past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles." It's again a translation of that Greek noun, ethnos. "Having pursued sensuality, lust, drunkenness, carousing, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries." So once again, a second time, Peter distinguishes his audience from the non-Jews, the Gentiles, which gives further impetus to the idea that the audience, that he's writing to must be Jewish in nature. Now, a lot of people, and this is where the MacArthur Study Bible goes, they just say, well, Gentiles means unbelievers. It doesn't necessarily mean non-Jews. And to that, I would quote Arnold Fruchtenbaum, who's done some wonderful work in this area in his book, The Messianic Jewish Epistles. His 1 Peter commentary, and really everything he's done in this commentary, I'd recommend to you. But Arnold Fruchtenbaum, in response to this idea that Gentiles just means unbelievers, says, however, there is no exegetical basis for such a conclusion. The meaning is not consistent with the normal usage found elsewhere in the New Testament. The word Gentile should be understood in its common primary meaning as a reference to the non-Jews. So if you look up ethnos in, for example, BDAG, what does BDAG stand for? That stands for Bauer, Danker, Arndt, A-R-N-D-T, Arndt, and Gingrich. Gingrich, no relation to the guy you see on Fox News all the time. Just a linguist, Gingrich. So BDAG is short for one of the leading lexicons of the time. Every vocation has certain code words it throws around. When you're at work, working under a car, or as a dishwasher repairman, or a police officer, or working retail, you know, you throw words, you know, shortened abbreviations of things around all the time, or else it would take you a long time to communicate with each other. Well, theology is the same way. We have certain dictionaries we use. One of them is called Bauer, Danker, Arndt, and Gingrich. Rather than saying that all the time, people just throw out the word BDAG. So if you look up ethnos in BDAG, it basically means Gentiles. It doesn't mean unbelievers. So Peter, when he says, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, is not just saying, keep your behavior excellent amongst believers. He's saying, you Jews, be different than the Gentiles. And the fact that he's distinguishing his audience from the Gentiles indicates that he is writing to a non-Gentile audience. So the only way you could write to a non-Gentile audience would be to be addressing which group of people? Jews. And that's who Peter is writing to. He's writing to believing Jews in the diaspora. And when you go back to 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9, I think this takes us to reason number 5. When you go back to 1 Peter 2, verse 9, look at the singular nouns here. Peter says to his audience, you are a race. Now, is race there? What kind of noun? Plural or singular? Singular. A royal priesthood. A holy nation. Plural noun or singular? Singular. You are a people. Plural or singular? Singular, for God's own possession. Now, that's a very poor description of the church, isn't it? As a whole. Because the church at large doesn't consist of a race, do we? Aren't we made up of multiple races? The church does not consist of a nation, does it? Aren't we made up of multiple nations? The church does not consist of a people, singular. Aren't we made up of multiple peoples? So the fact that the nouns are singular there indicates he's addressing a race, a nation, a people. He's addressing a race of people in the diaspora that are called aliens. He's addressing believing Jews. Because Peter, I think, if he's using that phrase or this verse to describe the church, would have flunked basic ecclesiology. Peter didn't take my ecclesiology class. Because in our ecclesiology class, we said that the church is neither Jew nor Greek, as Paul says. slave nor free, neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. I mean, the church is this great work of God that God has been doing for the last 2,000 years. And it doesn't just consist of Americans. It doesn't just consist of Israelis. I mean, it's made up of every racial group. And so why would Peter, if he's writing to the whole church, use these singular nouns like that? It doesn't make any sense. But it makes a lot of sense if you understand he's addressing a narrow audience within the church, Hebrew Christians. And by the way, you'll notice in 1 Peter 2, verse 9, Peter calls his audience a nation. Is the church a nation? I mean, the church is not a nation. Paul specifically says of the church, I will make you jealous, Israel, by that which is not a nation. So you see what God is doing in the present age as he pours out grace upon the church? I mean, he's poured out so much grace upon the church that the angels, Ephesians 3 verse 10, 1 Peter 1 verse 19, are stooping down to observe what's happening. They just can't believe the grace that we have. And as that grace, John 1, grace upon grace is poured out upon the church, who's being provoked to jealousy? Unbelieving Israel. God's taken on another woman. And God is actually using the present age of grace to stimulate Israel to have a desire for the gospel, which will be satisfied in the tribulation once the church is gone. But God is at work in the Jewish people right now through his work in the church. He's provoking them to jealousy. And you'll notice the instrument that he's using to provoke Israel to jealousy is specifically called not a nation. The church is not a nation. So if the church is not a nation, then how in the world could Peter be calling his audience, the church, a nation? Well, my answer is he's not talking to the whole church. He's talking to a narrow group of Hebrew Christians within the church. I think this takes us to my sixth reason why I think Peter is addressing a Jewish audience, and it really has to do with the book of Galatians. Galatians 2 verses 7 and 8 gives Peter's job description. But on the contrary, Paul says, seeing that I had been entrusted with the gospel to the uncircumcised, who would that be? Gentiles. Paul says, I take the gospel to the uncircumcised, the Gentiles, just as Peter had been to the circumcised. Who would that be? Jews. For he who effectively worked for Peter in his apostleship to the circumcised effectively worked for me also to the Gentiles. So Paul says, I'm the apostle to the Gentiles. Peter is the apostle to the who? To the Jews. So if Peter is the apostle to the Jews, is it a big shock that his two books would be addressed to the Jews? I mean, it shouldn't be a big shock at all. And again, people sort of balk at this. They say, well, didn't Peter share the gospel with Cornelius, a Gentile? Acts 10. And yes, he did. But you see, by the time the book of Galatians is written, AD 49, all of that has passed. And it's pretty well settled that Peter's job is to preach the gospel to the Jews, and Paul's job is to preach the gospel to the Gentiles. And I think this helps interpret, doesn't it? 1 Peter 5, verse 13. Boy, there's a lot of confusion on 1 Peter 5, verse 13. Even the Ryrie Study Bible note is confused on this. What does it say here? Peter signs off. She who was in, what's the next word? She who was in Babylon. Oh my goodness. Chosen together with you, sends you greetings, and so does my son Mark. And people pontificate as, what does he mean by Babylon? You know, I wrote my doctoral dissertation on Babylon. And I have a tremendous ability to babble on about Babylon. I could go on for weeks and weeks and weeks babbling on about Babylon. But let me give you the bottom line to the whole thing. When you see the word Babylon in the Bible, it means what?
Babylon.
See, I just took 300 pages and reduced it to that one sentence. That's all you got to know. Because you guys are studying with us on the book of Revelation, right? And eventually, now the rapture may occur before this happens. But eventually we're going to get to Revelation 17 and 18, where we learn about a great city named Babylon. And everybody and their mother, going back to Calvin and Luther, right up to the present, Dave Hunt, who I like, will tell you that, well, Babylon really means Rome. And you say, well, why do you think that? It doesn't say Rome, it says Babylon. And they're going to go over to 1 Peter 5, verse 13. And they're going to say, well, Babylon means Rome in 1 Peter 5, verse 13. So therefore, Babylon means Rome in Revelation 17 and 18. But you see what I've just done here? I've just cut out the whole argument from under him. Because Babylon in 1 Peter 5, verse 13 means Babylon. You say, well, why do you think that? Peter is the apostle to the Jews. Where were all the Jews? They were in Babylon because they went there for the 70-year captivity. And when they came back into the land following the 70-year captivity, as recorded in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, most of them didn't come back. Did you know that? Most of them were in disobedience and stayed in Babylon. In fact, the whole book of Esther is about those Jews living in Babylon when Haman developed a plot to exterminate them. And in fact, when you look at Acts 2, you don't have to turn there, but you might want to just jot it down, verse 9, you'll see that there were Babylonians listening to Peter preach on the day of Pentecost. So if all the Jews are still in Babylon and Peter is the apostle to the Jews, doesn't it make complete sense that he would go to Babylon? I mean, why would he go to Rome? Wasn't somebody else already in Rome? Isn't there a book in your Bible called the Book of, Book 2, the Romans? Paul had already covered Rome. Why would Peter go where Paul had already gone? It doesn't make any sense. But if you just take the Bible for what it says he went to Babylon. That's where he went. Because he's the apostle to the Jews, and that's where the Jews were. And you say, well, who's the she? She who is from Babylon greets you. That could be his wife. He was married. He had a mother-in-law, right? It's kind of hard to have a mother-in-law if you're not married. Did he take his wife 300 miles to Babylon, which is modern-day Iraq? Come on, honey, let's go to Babylon. Maybe so, maybe not, I don't know. Or the she could be the church in Babylon. Because the Greek noun for church is ekklesia, and what's the gender of ekklesia in Greek? It's feminine. So that could be the she. So how do we get a church in Babylon? Because there were people listening to Peter preach on the day of Pentecost that got saved. Jews, Acts 2, verse 9. From Babylon, and where did they go back to? They went back to Babylon and they spread the gospel. So Peter is going to Babylon to minister to that group and, you know, probably try to win others to Christ because that's where most of the Jews were. So you put all of this information together. I think there's about five arguments here that I think Peter is addressing a Jewish audience. Now, people will not take this lightly. They will not take this lying down. So let me very, very quickly give you the arguments that people use to argue that this is really a Gentile audience and not a Jewish audience in 1 Peter. The first thing they say is, well, it talks about how these people had come out of former ignorance. And people say, well, the Jews are the chosen people of God. And so how could a conversion out of Judaism be a conversion out of former ignorance? So they'll quote 1 Peter 1 verse 14, as obedient children, do not be conformed to the former lusts which were yours in your ignorance. So former ignorance couldn't be the Jewish race or nation, because that's God's chosen people. And I would counter that by quoting 1 Timothy 1 verse 13, where Paul himself was converted. Was Paul Jewish? Yes, he describes his conversion out of former ignorance. 1 Timothy 1:13. The second argument that people give, that this cannot be a Jewish audience, but it must be a Gentile audience, is it mentions the fact that originally, before they got saved, they had been handed down empty tradition from their fathers. 1 Peter 1:18 says, knowing that you were not redeemed with perishable things like silver or gold from your futile way of life inherited from your forefathers. People say, well, how could that be Judaism that they were converted out of here? I mean, it makes more sense for them to be converted out of Gentile paganism, because the Jews are the chosen people, and how could their background be looked at as, you know, empty tradition handed down from their fathers? And the counter to that argument is the empty tradition is Phariseeism. Not Hebrew Bible, but Phariseeism. Phariseeism, when did that come about? It came about after the Babylonian captivity. What did the nation of Israel, what sin were they committing to put them into the 70 years captivity? Anybody know what sin it was? Idolatry. So when they came out of the captivity after 70 years, they figured out what sent them into captivity. And so they purged the land of idols. And they sort of overreacted the opposite way. And they came up with extra biblical rules, Phariseeism. Man-made rules. What they did is they built a fence around the law. Building a fence around the law is you're so afraid of committing a particular sin that you pass a bunch of extra biblical rules so that you'll never get close to that sin ever again. And so they passed all these rules about Sabbath breaking, because they knew that Sabbath breaking put them into captivity. And that's why they're always in conflict with Jesus, Yeshua, because he heals someone on the Sabbath. And the religious leaders get all bent out of shape about that. Why are they bent out of shape? Because Jesus was breaking their rules. And that's why Jesus keeps talking about how he's the Lord of the Sabbath. And the Sabbath was meant for who? For man. And so if the Sabbath was meant for man, what's the problem with healing someone on the Sabbath? So Jesus was operating according to the original intent of the Sabbath. Where he was running into conflict was the man-made rules that they had imposed over the Sabbath. You see that? And that's what legalism is. It builds a fence around the law. It starts off well-intentioned, but eventually you got so many rules that the tail starts to wag the dog. If you want to see someone real early on in the Bible building a fence around the law, it's Eve, who was told, I would think, by her husband, not to eat from the tree of knowledge, or ye shall surely die. And when she's tempted by the serpent, you remember what she says? We can't eat of it or touch it. Go back to the original command. God never said anything about touching it. So what she did is she added a man-made regulation. It's because she was, I guess, trying to keep herself away from that forbidden fruit. that's basically the beginning of building a fence around the law. It's the beginning of legalism. Legalism is you're so afraid of committing a sin that in good intentions, you start to pass rules to keep you away from that sin. But what happens over time is the rules become more important than the original commands of God. That's why every church, you know, has to battle legalism all the time. You have to ask yourself all of the time, as leaders of a church, as leaders of this church, we're doing X, Y, and Z. Is this really in the Bible or not? Because what happens is man-made regulations come in and they start to usurp. They start off well-intentioned, but if not monitored, the tail can wag the dog. You see that? And that's what Judaism was, you know, in the time of Christ. That's why Jesus in Mark 7 verse 13 says, thus invalidating the word of God by your tradition which you have handed down. So it was a complete mess. There was something called the Talmud that they had passed, which is, I had to read some of that in seminary. It's exhausting reading. Rule after rule after rule, not found anywhere in the Old Testament. Then they had one in the land of Israel, then they had a whole different one in Babylon, because that's where the Jews remain, many of them, called the Babylonian Talmud. So you've got the IRS tax code times two. And when you understand this, you understand why Christ is always in conflict with these Pharisees, because they're imposing the rules, and he wants to get back to the original intent of Scripture. And that's why 1 Peter 1 verse 18 says, you have been redeemed now as a believing Jew from your futile way of life that you've inherited. It's a statement against Phariseeism and Mishnah and all of these kinds of things. So the statement, you've been removed from the empty tradition handed down to you, could very easily apply to a Jewish audience if you understand the legalism that the nation was under at this particular time in history. And other people say, well, it says here, 1 Peter 2, verse 9, that they've been taken out of darkness into the light. Peter's audience had been taken out of the darkness into the light. Now, how could that be a description of getting saved from Judaism when the Jews are the chosen people? Well, again, I'll counter with statements that are made elsewhere in the Bible. I'm not sure we have time to look at all of these, but jot these down. Isaiah 6, 9 and 10. Matthew 13, verse 14. And 2 Corinthians 3, 13 through 16. Isaiah 6, 9 and 10, Matthew 13, verse 14, 2 Corinthians 3, verses 13 through 16, and you'll see all of those statements refer to Jews without Christ as in darkness. So the statement, you've been taken out of darkness, could easily apply to a Jewish audience. Now, here's the one that really gets people, is they say they had been redeemed out of idolatry. Peter says, for the time is past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles, having pursued a course of sensuality, lust, drunkenness, carousing, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. They had been saved out of idolatry. And there was one thing that first century Israel wasn't. It was idolatrous. They may have had a lot of problems, but they didn't worship idols anymore. Idols being statues. Do you know what ridded them of idolatry? The Babylonian captivity. Because they figured out that idolatry got us shipped 300 miles to the east to modern day Iraq, and they were there for 70 years. And when they came back out, they said, we're never doing that again. And so they ridded the land of idols. So post-exilic Israel is non-idolatrous, meaning worshiping statues. Pre-exilic Israel is very idolatrous. And the Pharisees started to come into existence at this time, and they purged the land of idols. So there's where they went to Babylonian captivity. There's another map of it and a third map of it. So if that's true, then how could Peter, to a Jewish audience, say to them, you've been redeemed from idolatry? And the answer to that is idolatry is a lot more than a metal statue. You can be idolatrous without bowing down to any statue. What is idolatry? It's anything you put in your life for significance or worth or petition for need other than God. And so Paul calls idolatry a work of the what? A work of the flesh. A work of the sin nature. See, I can go through my whole life without bowing down to a single statue. And I could be completely idolatrous. I could attach worth to money over God, any number of things. So Paul says, now the deeds of the flesh are evident, which are immorality, impurity, sensuality, and then there's the word idolatry. That's the exact same Greek word that Peter uses in 1 Peter 4, verse 3, to describe what the audience had been redeemed out of. So just because it says idolatry doesn't disqualify 1 Peter from being written to a Jewish audience. Because idolatry can take place in the human heart. Because it's a work of the flesh. And then one more quick argument that people use to argue that Peter's audience had to have been written to non-Jews is they say, well, Peter uses the Greek version of his name. 1 Peter 1, verse 1, he calls himself Peter or Petros, which is the Greek name for Peter. Now, Peter has one name in three languages. When he's using the name Simon, he's using the Hebrew understanding of his name. When he uses the word Cephas, by the way, the word Simon you'll find in Luke 2:22-31. And Simon, Cephas you'll find in 1 Corinthians 1:12, 1 Corinthians 9, verse 5. So Cephas is the Aramaic name of Peter. Simon is the Hebrew name of Peter. And Petros is the what? Greek name for Peter. So people say, well, this couldn't have been written to a Jewish audience because he would have used his Hebrew name or his Aramaic name. See that? The answer to that is, who is Peter writing to? Look back at 1 Peter 1, verse 1. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who reside as aliens scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. Who's he writing to there? People, where's he writing from? Babylon in the east. You say, well, why do you take Babylon literally? Do you take these other names here literally? Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia. Everybody takes those literally. So at the beginning of the book, the geography is literal, but at the end of the book, it's not. Don't get me started. I mean, why not just take the whole Bible for what it says? And if you take the whole Bible for what it says, it's going to ameliorate, if that's a word, a lot of crazy end times theories about the Vatican being the Antichrist in the last days and things of that nature. I'm no fan of Roman Catholicism, believe me. And I think Roman Catholicism is going to be involved some way in the New World Order, no doubt about it. But the center of authority in the book of Revelation is not Rome. It's Babylon, because Babylon means Babylon. I mean, we get that with Israel, right? Doesn't Israel mean Israel? Doesn't mean the church. So why do we, with Babylon, think Babylon means something else? Well, I'll tell you why we think that. See, I'm taking my own bait and I'm talking about something I shouldn't be talking about. But Luther figured out really quick that if you called the Pope the Antichrist, that'll preach. I mean, people liked hearing that. And so he kept doing it, and he got more popular, and so this kind of stuck around that Babylon equals Rome. It was Luther that really pushed all these ideas. Anyway, why doesn't Peter use his Hebrew name or his Aramaic name? It has to do with who he's writing to in north central Galatia and what language you think they all spoke up there. They spoke Greek. Even though they were Jews in the diaspora, they were Greek speaking. That's why he's using his Greek name. Not because he's necessarily writing to a Gentile audience. So, 1 Peter is not addressed to the church as a whole. It's addressed to Hebrew Christians within the church. We can see that from 1 Peter itself and answering arguments against that position. What about the church fathers? What did they believe? With very few exceptions, the fathers believe that this letter was written by the Gerald Bray speaking, written by the Apostle Peter and sent to Jewish Christians in the diaspora. Eusebius of Caesarea, Didymus, Andreas, that other name there I can't pronounce. They recognize that the letter has close resemblance to James, and they accounted for this by saying that both men were apostles to the Jews, though Peter seems to have been concentrated more on those who lived outside of Palestine. So the early church fathers believe 1 Peter was written to a Jewish audience. Other scholars, more modern, that believe Peter was written to a Jewish audience include John Calvin, Bengel, Wiest, Alford, English, and Weiss. So this is not some weird view that I'm teaching you here. So if there's evidence from 1 Peter that the book was written to a Jewish audience, and if the arguments that it was written to a Gentile audience can be answered, and if the earliest church fathers believed it was written to a Jewish audience, so what? Well, that means 1 Peter 2 verse 9 has a very limited application. 1 Peter is part of a unique set of books in the New Testament. There's six of them that are written specifically to answer questions that a Jewish Christian would be struggling with in the age of the church when it first started. So what are those books? Anybody know? Which gospel? Matthew. John is pretty clear, is written to a Gentile audience. Which epistles? One of them we've looked at, James, written to the 12 tribes. Hebrews, doesn't that sound kind of Jewish? Kind of has a Jewish ring to it. Hebrews. Now, Peter is the apostle to the Jews. How many books did he write? Two, so that would be 1 Peter and 2 Peter. And what book, when you read it, sounds an awful lot like 2 Peter? Jude. So it's kind of taken that Jude is written to the same audience, Hebrew Christian audience. So it's just important when you read these to understand who the actual recipients are. I'm not saying that as a Gentile Christian, I can't apply truths of them to my life. But I'm not going to build a theology of replacement theology from 1 Peter 2 verse 9 when 1 Peter wasn't even written to the whole church. Arnold Fruchtenbaum writes, of the 21 epistles in the New Testament, 5 were written to Jewish believers, dealing with the needs of Jewish believers and specific issues that Jewish believers faced. There are things in these epistles that are applicable to all believers, but some are true only of Jewish believers. The 5 epistles, now he's left off the Gospel of Matthew because he's just dealing with the epistles in his work here. These 5 epistles are Hebrews, James, 1 Peter, 2 Peter, and Jude. Therefore, 1 Peter 2, verse 9 has a highly limited application. What is 1 Peter 2, verse 9 really saying then when it calls the audience a kingdom of priests? What is it saying? What it's saying is Israel as a whole failed to live up to God's calling at Mount Sinai. She failed to live up to her calling as a kingdom of priests. But the believing Jewish remnant within the church has fulfilled that calling. So Israel failed to live up as a nation to her calling as a kingdom of priests thus far in redemptive history. But the believing Jewish remnant within the church is fulfilling that calling. That's Peter's point. Arnold Fruchtenbaum puts it this way. It should be kept in mind that Peter is writing to Jewish believers throughout Scripture. There are always two Israels. Israel, the whole that comprises all Jews, and Israel, the remnant that comprises all believing Jews. Here Peter distinguishes between the remnant and the non-remnant. Replacement theology, however, relies on this passage as proof that the true Israel is the what? The church. And they all do this. This is a favorite passage of those who teach replacement theology. They teach that what the Old Testament stated to be true of Israel, Peter now applies and states it to be true of the church, meaning the church has replaced Israel and the kingdom has begun. Thus, they conclude that the church has replaced Israel. However, there is no hint in the epistle that Peter is addressing the church as a whole. On the contrary, in the epistle's introduction, he stated that he was addressing Jewish believers who specifically comprised what then was the remnant of Israel. Now, what will we call that believing Jewish remnant within the church? Paul has a word for them. They're called the Israel of God. The Israel of God, Galatians 6:16, doesn't cover the whole church. It covers the believing Jews within the church. That's who Peter's addressing. It is important to recognize that the contrast Peter makes here is not between the church and Israel, or between believers and non-believers, or between unbelieving Jews and believing Gentiles. Rather, the contrast here is between the remnant and the non-remnant of Israel. Peter's point is that while Israel, the whole, failed to fulfill its calling, the remnant of Israel has not failed to fulfill its calling. So if what we have said here is true, you can't use this verse to promote replacement theology. Because the letter was never written to the whole church. Well, let's pretend it is written to the whole church. Well, then you use argument A, similarity is not equality. But the truth of the matter is the book was never written to the whole church. And so that's basically how you handle 1 Peter 2 and verse 9. So when we get back together after summer hiatus, we'll look at a few verses in the book of Revelation. You guys are already experts in the book of Revelation, right? That allegedly support Kingdom Now theology. Then we'll be looking at some miscellaneous arguments that people use outside the Bible to support Kingdom Now theology. And then we'll be getting to the so what question. Why does it matter? Which I probably should have written first. I mean, I've dragged you along for 70 lessons, and you're wondering, why is this significant? Well, part three of the book is the so what. It changes the mission and calling of the church, which is what we'll get into. All right, so I'm finished talking.